This is Steve Schrock with another Franklin Matters radio show, number 678 in the series. This session of the radio show shares the Franklin Mass School Committee Budget Workshop held on Tuesday, December 14, 2021. The budget workshop was conducted in the third floor training room of the municipal building. Six of the seven school committee members were present, along with the superintendent and other central office personnel. The recording of the public meeting runs about 51 minutes. Links to the meeting agenda and associated docs released for this meeting are included in the show notes. The link to my notes taken during the meeting is also provided. So let's listen to this segment of the school committee budget workshop for December 14, 2021.
Time being 6:04, I call to order our budget workshop. So just as an FYI, meetings may be recorded by Franklin Matters. So Sarah and Miriam, if you wanted to take it away.
Sure. So tonight we're going to give you a high-level overview of the budget, the process, listen to what you your priorities as a school committee are, go through a little bit of the current budget, again high level, and then give you some additional resources to take away. I have about an hour, and we will start with the budget process. The process overall is the same one on an annual basis. It does change a little bit from year to year based on what whether it's an election year or depending on the schedule of the calendar. But generally, we start in September, October. We wait for our October 1 enrollment numbers. That's going to dictate what our state aid Chapter 70 is based on. We look to have a budget workshop around this time, November, December, to hear what your priorities are. So that we can include those priorities as we develop our next year's budget. We have already started meeting with our administrative team to hear district-based priorities, level-based priorities, as well as individual school priorities, staffing needs, all that kind of thing. And those meetings will continue throughout the month of January. Into February, when generally we would present to you the superintendent would present to you her recommended budget. That this year, based on the calendar with one meeting in February, that budget is presenting, we're scheduled for March 8th to present the superintendent's recommended budget. Then the budget subcommittee would have an opportunity to discuss before that, and an iteration in between. The school committee would also have discussions at every meeting when the superintendent presents. Then there would be a public hearing to give the school committee a chance to discuss as well, listen to public input. Again, the budget subcommittee would have another iteration of the process, and then the school committee would look to adopt a budget in April, and right now that's scheduled for April 12th. After that, it would go to the finance committee, and the town finance committee would review, ask any questions they might have, and at that point, it would go to the council for recommendation, and the council would vote an appropriation. Generally, that happens the third or so week in May. I think we're looking at maybe the 18th or so. That's a guess, because I don't think those dates are set. So that is what the process looks like right now. This is just a little bit more of a detailed timeline, which speaks to some of the things I just talked about. And it was also included in your packet, so you can take a look at that. There aren't specific dates for any of these, for some of the budget subcommittee meetings, because we haven't gotten that far yet, or for the FinCom meetings, which again could happen late March or April, and the 18th right now is a guess. As you know, July 1 begins our implementation of the 2023 budget, so we're planning that now for several months out. Okay. So, priorities. Oh, sorry, I caught her at a bad moment. But we're going to talk with you about, yes,
so question. Good question. So I know that we have like contract negotiations for this year. Mm-hmm. How does that factor into the timeline?
Yeah, so the budget subcommittee will have a discussion about that. We don't expect that we're going to be finished with negotiations before this budget is developed. We'll put in an estimate of what we think we might be able to afford and what we think, where we think we might land, maybe. But we will bargain in good faith based on what we have, what the budget subcommittee discusses, and go from there.
Thank you.
Good question. We put in a placeholder. So in terms of priorities, we want to have a conversation with you and hear from you as school committee members about, as we work towards the superintendent's recommended budget and as we, you know, have conversations with the budget subcommittee, what are some of your areas of priority based on based on a number of things. I think you've all been educating yourself on the budget through the entire election process, and that's why we're now sort of walking back through some of the basics. What are some of the priorities that you would like to see us be sure that we're taking into consideration? We asked our building administrators the same questions and are kind of putting all of these pieces together in terms of a proposal to you.
I guess we'll just go down the line, if that's okay. Camille, did you want to go first? I'm going to go in alphabetical order. Sorry, you go first.
No, it's fine. I don't know how to phrase this, but I know that common planning time costs money, mm-hmm. indirectly. Those sorts of, or PLCs, or, I mean, that time is money, so. I wish I could say widgets, but it's something that AMORC does as giving teachers time to meet together collaboratively, work on that integration, vertical integration that is in their goals. So that would be a priority.
You all set?
I'm all set.
All right. Dave Callahan?
So one thing would just be about teacher retention. And like one, even just a small actionable one would be to try to make our sub prices, like what we would pay for substitutes coming in, a bit more competitive, just to ensure that we always have a steady supply of subs coming in so we don't have to kind of pull specialists or admin to fill some of those roles.
I think for me, one thing I heard a lot of clear from families is around the programs from the students. So how can we have funding to support these programs that go above and beyond what's in the classrooms and really provide more enrichment, more opportunities so that the students can get more exposure to different aspects of just their various fields.
To various fields?
Fields, yeah.
Do you have some examples?
So like there was the, that's not DECA, but like we'll just say for example the robotic program. Mm-hmm. So different programs like that. Mm-hmm. If we see what we can offer more, especially at the high school and middle school. Mm-hmm.
Like languages and
Yeah, exactly.
Okay,
yeah. Choir, things that we've reduced over the past few years.
Yeah.
So how can we get those back?
Mm-hmm.
So that's it. Yes,
that's it.
Dave
McNeil? Yes. So, a few things. I think mental health is, just that has been just such a pressing topic during the pandemic and will continue to be so as we continue to both navigate the pandemic and come out of it. So I know recent priorities have been for interventionists and counselors. I think making sure that we not only retain those, but also expand upon them as needed to ensure that our students have those proper socio-emotional mental health supports during and successfully transitioning out of the pandemic is going to be enormous. I would say Also, in terms of technology, seeing what are maybe next generation either curricula or technologies, would it be, obviously computers are there, but other programs of programming or maybe other STEM resources we can provide to see like what are the maybe next generation programs and that we can provide for students to kind of give them the an edge in the modern and future workplace. And so trying to understand what are the things we could procure and to facilitate that. And also if there are other, other technologies that had to come up during the pandemic in terms of communication or just other things that, to better facilitate what the future of schooling is going to look like. And then maybe lastly, obviously we had to cut a few things and due to budget constraints with languages and music and library and other resources. If we feel that that there's a need there to bring something back and prioritize some things that had to be cut, and then bring them back in order to fill the holes that are already there. And I mean, I know with the tutors, with the ESSER funding, if we think that there's continues to be need with additional tutors to make sure that students are being provided the academic support that they need to address learning loss during the pandemic and to make sure, again, there's the successful academic transition post-pandemic, if we see strong needs there, that those are addressed as well.
I agree with all of these, and to piggyback on Dave McNeil's mental health category, I think staff and student well-being is a common theme we've been hearing loud and clear the last 2 years. I think the counseling review that was done a couple of years ago was so helpful in sort of order for us to get an understanding of like what exists in the district, what the district's doing well, what needs to be modified. And so I don't know if we could update that. I think it's a couple of years old at this point, so I don't know if that's worth updating. I think sometimes it's easier to make these types of decisions based on something like an outside review like that, because I feel like we've referred to that so many times, it held a lot of power and it was really helpful, I think, for everybody to have a common understanding. And so we'll see what that says, or how we can use that. And then I also think, our SWAC is so strong, and since we're going through the WellSat sort of assessment process, looking at our policies, and maybe some recommendations will come out of SWAC, I'm anticipating, even from some preliminary conversations, such as our high school students are creatively getting the amount of physical activity time required, but I feel like that physical activity is important for brains and learning and mental health and everything else, so I'll leave that there. But I do wonder if SWAC will have some recommendations. Also, the DEI committee is so powerful and motivated and invested and really moving, and so I'm wondering if those subcommittees, I'm only on one, but we have a lot of great ideas, and I'm guessing that all the subcommittees have a lot of really great ideas for moving that work forward in the district, and so I would think that some are related to budget matters, and so I'm thinking there'll be some like budgetary things coming out of DEI subcommittees and the equity audit, of course. And then I know we're working on multi-tiered systems of support in the district, and I really feel like strengthening tier one is probably a priority. Looking at the social emotional learning, the universal design for learning, it's like tier one's gotten more intensive over the last year and a half, and so that sort of has changed things, where what we thought was tier one before is not enough in a lot of cases, I'm imagining, including things like trauma-informed practices, looking at the pre-referral process, inclusive practices across general education for all needs, and then restorative practices. So really like a massive bucket there that's including so many of the district's initiatives, but really it all falls into the MTSS framework, but so much of it's in tier one. I feel like before we were talking about a lot of the stuff in tier two, and now it's like everybody needs it. And so that sort of changes, I think, my perspective at least, like when we're looking at the budget, because we're not looking at, 15% of the population, maybe we're looking at a larger percent. And so that has money like dollar signs.
You said four things right in a row. If I could just ask you to repeat them, what it was: trauma informed, something else, inclusive, restorative.
The pre-referral process. Yeah, I know we've talked about that off and on. I feel like that's such a big, it's such a big piece. And I guess we haven't talked about it in a while, so I guess I'm not really sure how things are going, but I'm imagining they're busy.
Mm-hmm. So just to kind of agree with everything that Elise just said and everyone else, but just I think that it's important to, I want to focus on the kind of the boots on the ground personnel. So, you know, I'd like to see maybe another REACH coordinator at the high school. I feel like their numbers have gone way up.
Can you tell what REACH is?
Not the acronym, but what is it?
It's a specialized program.
Yeah.
For students, are we in charge of
Paula? Yeah. You guys are doing a great job, Paula.
For students with social emotional challenges.
Okay, we have that. Okay, great.
What's it called in NID?
North Star and Compass.
North Star and Compass?
Yeah. North Star is one, Compass is the other.
Every district has a few.
I just assumed it was just all like the same each district. I didn't know that it was all
different. You know
what,
you feel
names.
Bad, we'll make a really fancy name. I know.
Sometimes they're acronyms and sometimes they're just
names. Yeah. And I think to interventionists and special education staff at the elementary and middle schools, those are really my top three priorities. Does anybody else have anything else that they've maybe thought of while everyone else was talking? And I can ask, if you want, I can get some info from Megan too.
Sure.
Share that.
Yeah, that would be great. Okay. And this is just the beginning, and there's more to come, and more discussion and iteration and figuring things out. But wanted to kind of open it up to get your general sense and general priorities. And I think these are pretty consistent with what the administrators had shared. Interventionists, programs to expand upon exposure and opportunities for students come to mind. Support for tier one instruction is a big priority area. We know that our special education numbers are not increasing. That's sort of something that I think has been put out there as sort of a soundbite. But it's not true. If you look at the demographic information from October, we've been relatively stable there for at least as long as we've been capturing that data. But what we are noticing are, I think, some increased needs among students and expansion of our specialized programs. So I think both in the short term, you'll see things related to our specialized programs and special education staffing there. But in the long term, that's something that we've been talking about forecasting and wrapping our heads around, both from a staffing perspective as well as a space perspective. All of our schools at this point have at least one specialized program within their school building. And we love that, and that students are included in the Franklin school environment, even if they might not be in their neighborhood school. It enriches all of us in terms of our community with those inclusive practices. But it does require additional staffing, it does require additional space, and in the end though, these students might otherwise be out of district, and so there's lots of reasons to want to have those inclusive programs in our schools. More information to come on that in January. We're going to do a special education presentation so that you're more acquainted with the range of services in the special education department in advance of the budget coming up. But yeah, this is, I think, pretty consistent with some of the things that we've been talking about, and including the common planning time and making sure that teachers have that time to work together, particularly if they're focused on tier one. Right, and strengthening that tier one, they need time to be able to do that. So thank you for putting those on the table, and it's not the only opportunity. There'll be more conversation related to the budget. As we put together the agenda, and Miriam had run this by Dave, who's the chair of the budget subcommittee, we were trying to think about information that you may not have seen or may not have had access to through some of the presentations that we've done more recently or the budget book as it exists online. I feel like you've been doing a lot of homework all along, and we had just done kind of a school finance 101 to town council, and I think many of you attended it. So we didn't walk back through all of the basics of school finance, but we did include some additional data. Were you going to talk about fees?
Yeah.
And so one of the things that we thought you might not have as much familiarity with are the history of fees for Franklin Public Schools and how that contributes to the budget.
So this is a schedule of our fee structure. Any fees that we collect go into a revolving account specifically for that purpose. So transportation being one of them. Right now the fee is $360 per student per year with a family cap of $1,060. It was initiated in 2003, increased in 2008, and again in 2020. We generally pay a total expense of about $1.4 million in transportation. It's about a 65-35% split based on the fees that are used to cover the cost of transportation and the operating budget. Extracurricular clubs and activities, we're charging $75 for any club at the middle or high school level, any or as many as students want to participate in. Again, initiated in 2008 with increase in 2020. Most of our extracurricular costs come from the budget. The fee is very small, nominal, and we offset about 15% from fees to the full cost of about $263,000 a year. And then our athletic fees, you can see that's by sport. We haven't the last increase was in 2020. We generally pay about $856,000 to $900,000, depending, you know, pre-pandemic it was closer to $900,000 than the pandemic, and so sports changed, as did everything else. And that's a 60-40 split for revolving and the general fund. On a monthly basis, you see a summary of the revolving accounts. It looks like this. You generally will see it in the budget to actual report that you get at the first meeting of the month, and those fees that are collected go into one of these accounts. We generally offset the budget by revolving fees and other revolving accounts, roughly $5 million a year. And that's included in some of the budget detail that you can see on the website in the executive summary and in the detail of the revolving accounts. Also, in terms of fees, there's a link here to SuperEdNet. SuperEdNet is, I think, a retired superintendent that puts together data from various schools. You can see the date of the last update of this was July 9, 2020, but you want to pay attention to the date of the last update that the school district sent their data. So some of it is not as up to date as you might think, but it just gives you an idea of where fees across the board fall. And I can't even tell you when the last time we sent our data to them or whether they asked for it. Let's see what they have reported here. They have us at 200 per sport, which is 2013. So updated is questionable. So that's where that is. But it just does give you a flavor for what other districts in this state are charging for or not charging for or collecting. So.
We increased our fees in 2020 athletics, right?
Yes.
But before that, it was like 2008.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
With the idea that the expenses have been increasing since 2008, and that helps to partially offset, but you can see that the fees are going towards a minority of the overall budget in each of those areas by varying amounts.
Right.
Do you know, if I may,
please,
how many families are capped for the transportation cost?
So capped, if a family has three or more students, they're capped at the cost. And I want to say maybe probably less than a dozen. I wouldn't know off the top of my head. There are not very many that are capped. One other thing you should know about transportation fees is that by law, if a family qualifies for free or reduced meals, then they automatically qualify for a waiver of the transportation fee. So they wouldn't pay for transportation regardless. So we're required by law to transport students grades K through 6 who live over 2 miles from their neighborhood school. And we afford parents the opportunity to take the bus if they live within that mileage or have students in grades 7 through 12. And then if they qualify for meals, then if there is a fee associated with that, we would then waive that fee.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
So for the clubs and activities, do you know like what's the take rate for that in terms of the students? Like, are we seeing like 60% of the population take part in the club, or?
So club participation varies by school based on the offerings. Of course, the high school has the most number of clubs, and you can see them all listed on the high school's website as well as the middle school clubs and activities website. I would say, you know, I don't generally get and nor keep the list of kids participating. That's at the building level. But I think that clubs and activities have expanded and grown, even during the pandemic. We had to reduce some of our offerings, obviously, but I think kids are ready to come back and be part of clubs and activities.
And then just a follow-up on that one. I know you said you don't monitor the participation rate, but do we have a sense that, on average, how many clubs does a kid participate in? Like, is it just like one, or are the kids that are in like, you know, 5+ clubs, do you know?
I think it varies. I think there are kids who I know I'll hear, my kid is only participating in this club, or they've decided they don't want to participate in this club and they don't want to be in any other club, so they might look for a refund. But I think in general, you know, kids have lots of different scheduled events after school as well as clubs and activities. So I think they find their niche, and so you might not find students who might participate in athletics might not be able to avail themselves of certain clubs because there's a conflict there. So
it varies, but the principals monitor participation because they make decisions each year on what clubs
and which clubs to run.
We've also seen since the pandemic some cross-collaboration,
yes,
like at the middle schools, to have clubs that existed independently come together for not every meeting, but certain meetings. So I think they're pretty, they're aware of kind of what's working and what's not, and they're always trying to put what's going to provide the most vibrant after school life for kids. And oftentimes a kid who takes more than one, depending on what's available. But certainly, if you find a niche, like an art type thing,
right,
that might just be what
they're going to run with it.
We can try to quantify it a little bit by looking at the amount of fees collected.
Yeah, so in terms of fee structure, I would say overall probably $50,000 between the high school and the middle schools. Doesn't necessarily tell you whether the student is in one club or 10 clubs, but it's about an estimate for what our annual income is.
The number of people participating.
Yeah, right.
Can I ask a follow-up question?
Sure.
So I've been curious about that too this year, just having a middle schooler for the first time and like hearing all this talk about clubs for years and years and years and then finally like learning about what it's all about. I wonder, is there a way that we could get the report from the principals that sort of shows like how many clubs are offered this year versus pandemic year versus in the past couple of years? I think, you know, it's like
just paying like an average of how many kids.
Yeah, like if they used to offer 15 at each building and now they're offering 6, then that's a big difference. Like if a family's paying $75 and the kids want to take so many, but they're like,
oh. Yeah, I mean, we can do a report to get you some information about the extracurriculars. One thing that I would say is 15 to 6, like we have reduced the offerings, but which sounds bad. But we also were running clubs with 1 or 2 students. And that doesn't really support the idea that it's an important social connection and learning opportunity. So we've pared back, and the principals, middle school in particular, not the high school so much, but the middle school principals have pared back to strengthen the remaining clubs that are there to try to bolster those. And then where possible, collaborate across those schools, again, to kind of strengthen them. But we can create like a report of the extracurricular offerings. I think there's also some important things to know about the clubs that aren't stipended. And that's a real issue that I think we've been looking to tackle.
Yeah, and I have some of that detail data because we have a stipend committee that is talking about that now in terms of a structure, because we have quite a few clubs at the high school that are running that the advisor is not getting a stipend for, and so we're kind of looking at some of the equities among clubs and activities and stipends and that kind of thing. Participation in some clubs, like I'll give you an example that came up today. Science National Honor Society has close to 115 kids in it with 2 advisors versus I know that middle school principals tend to not run a club if there are fewer than 10 students participating. Same at the high school. So if a high school student wants to start a new club, they have to come with a request to start a new club with at least 10 signatures of kids who might want to participate in that. So those are kinds of things that we're looking at now to look at our structure of clubs and activities. Some of those clubs are also outlined in the collective bargaining agreement, which is also on the website. It's in Appendix A, I want to say, right before Appendix A, right after the salary goods. So, anyway.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Just one other question on that. So in terms of like the expense for each club, how is that determined? Is that set by the principals or is that?
So that's a contracted rate.
Okay.
So the stipends are outlined in the contract and the rate for that stipend based on whichever club it is outlined. And that's one of the things we are coming together as a committee, as a subcommittee of the FEA and the administration to tackle some of the inequities that might be visible there.
So beyond the stipend, there's no other kind of cost to run some of the clubs?
Yeah, so there are some costs associated with running some of the clubs. Ski Club, for example, runs and that's a parent cost for the cost of the ticket. Students sometimes will fundraise for clubs. To pay for the cost of busing. So there are some clubs that have a greater cost associated with them, such as that,
but
versus
be appearing in the budget here, because that would be a fundraiser.
Right. Yeah. Right. So we generally don't use, so student activity money is an agency. We are the agents and the keepers of the students' money. And so we don't use student activity money to offset the budget. The only fees that we take in are for the extracurricular that offset generally the cost of the stipend.
Thank you very much.
Sure. So just a general overview, I put in a link to the executive summary. Again, it's on the website.
So I'm not going to go through all of this, but I will tell you relative to the structure as we look to develop the budget, it will be with the priorities and the portrait of a graduate in mind. But I will point out some of the high-level detail. New investments will come up. The timeline is in here. So just big picture, you know, 85% of the school's budget is salaries and healthcare benefits. 3%, 3.6 in transportation, 4.2 in other expenses. That's your supplies and materials, contracted services, and just under 7% for out-of-district tuition. So when this comes to you for FY23, you're going to see a similar format from a high level, from major categories, and as you drill down, you'll see the 11 categories that the Department of Ed outlines when they look to allocate the foundation budget using these 11 categories. And then you'll see the detail of each of the 11 categories detailed further on in the report. And as you get to the bottom of the executive summary, you'll see the amount of revolving funds that were offset in the budget and the state and federal grants that we know about at the time. I will tell you that at this point in time, we're looking at roughly $4.6 million in grant money that was either awarded to us last year and still carrying over for this year, or awarded to us this year for expense. Some of them will expire at the end of this year, some will expire at the end of next year, some will expire at the end of 2024. And then we have a couple of grants that we've applied for that we're waiting to hear on. Then the other document that I've outlined for you is just, again, in more detail. So once you get through the executive summary, then you see this high-level overview by school, and then by the what I'm going to call the DOE function. It's the Department of Ed, their function code, which rolls up to those 11 categories. I haven't attached it here, but the further level detail will be by school, by this Department of Ed code. Questions on that? Anything? Okay. I would be remiss if I didn't speak to non-budgeted donations, which this is hard to see, and it's in your packet. But this is a summary of donations that we receive generally from the PCCs, also from FEF and other community groups over the past 10 years. So they have been very generous to our schools and our district. And I would be remiss in not mentioning that. So you can take a look at that. What happened in 2019?
Yeah, there was a couple of really nice donors.
Some of the things that happened where you see those in the first line, that was the year that the concession stand was built at the Franklin High School. So that was a non-revenue donation, right? So the new concession stand was built and donated to the district. So that's what you see in 2019. The $179,000 that you see in 21 is for the DESI HEPA filters that you see throughout the building here and throughout the schools. And if you notice back in 2013, you'll see $131,000 for the JFK playground.
What's not captured on there is any direct spending that may occur from booster
Correct.
Organizations, FBF, or PCCs. And so there may be some direct spending that they do that does not funnel through us for Field trips, maybe?
So field trips, sometimes they'll pay a vendor directly the field trip, but we'll pay for the bus, or they'll donate the money for the bus. Sometimes they'll pay for a visitor to come in and provide, I'm going to say a puppet show because it's the first thing that comes to mind. But
math, like math mornings.
Right, the author visit. Author so visit, so yeah. Those kinds of things.
Puppets are cool too.
Right, right.
Marionettes,
yeah. I don't know why that came to mind, but probably from 15 years ago.
I'm going to have a puppet that speaks for me.
And then I've given you some additional resources. So the Department of Ed puts out what they call the district analysis and review tools. And so you can take a look at it, but it's basically a level of detail. I'm going to choose staffing and finance because that's what I do. Mm-hmm. But you can see these other files that are available to download. And once you download the file, then you have an opportunity to put in a district, Franklin or any other district, and it will come up with a variety of comparable districts. So I'm just going to put in Abington at this point, and it will come up with the data for Abington in this case, and it will give you total enrolled, how much your your free and reduced lunch population is, your students with disabilities, your percentages for English language learners, gives you growth percentiles and meeting and exceeding expectations, and then each one of these will give you the number of students, the number of teacher FTEs for this district and any other district that you choose. These are the comparables that the Department of Ed chooses, but if you wanted to see our district with specific districts, either districts that are surrounding us or districts that are demographically comparable to us, that data is available on the department's website through this DART module. And then I've linked a chart of accounts, which basically gives you a quick reference to those DOE functions that I talked about. And then a quick overview of some charter school finance. So I have included some charter schools, or being independent public schools, they receive their revenue from simply stated, each district sends a number of students and pays their per pupil cost, basically. So if we had 300 students in the charter school and our per pupil cost is $14,000, we're paying 300 times 14,000 as our assessment to the charter school. That's the simple version of how the charter school collects gets their funding. The state calculates it out very complex, in a complex fashion, and it's identified in this link here that is there. And it's and while it's a little bit of a dated document, I think it goes back to 2016 right here, it does talk about the tuition payments and how charter schools are funded, and you can take a look at that. The history of our assessments at $5 million and our reimbursements for this year at roughly $365,000.
And this is not money that sort of Franklin Public Schools sees. This is done more on the municipal side. This does not run through our office in either in the assessment or in the reimbursement.
Right, so it's not part of the budget, but it is part of the big picture in the municipal finance. Mm-hmm. It's part of the town's budget, I guess I should say. Because the town has to account for it off of the cherry sheet. Mm-hmm. So it will be part of the revenue that the town gets is that $360,000-ish, but they're also going to pay $5 million towards the charter school. So our Franklin enrollment in the charter school as of 2022 is 370 students. You can see the history of that. You can see the blurb, the blip from 2018-19 to 2020, where we where the charter school expansion began, and when they moved into a new location and started expanding their classes. Their total enrollment is most recently on the website is 708 students as of 2020.
So, quick question about the charter.
Sure.
So, I know since they only go to middle school, at high school, they're going to have to go to Franklin High or some other place. Do you know what percentage of those charter students go to Franklin High, or do they choose to go someplace else?
It's the large majority come to Franklin High School.
Okay.
I don't know the number off the top of my head, but a large majority come to Franklin High.
And then I know right now, charter doesn't do middle school, but they're large enough, it's a high school, but they're large enough to expand. Any thoughts on like how do you prepare so that if they do go to high school route, we can kind of get the students to come to Franklin High School versus staying at charter?
So if they were to expand to high school, they would have to go through a process with the state to expand or revise their charter, and there's an opportunity for the sending districts to kind of send in impact statements and advocate regarding the impact on the local community, and then the Department of Education would take that into consideration with respect to approval. I have not heard any rumblings of that. I don't know if you have, but I haven't heard any rumblings of them potentially going to the high school. The high school level.
Gotcha.
But that's kind of how it would go.
Gotcha. Yeah, no, I didn't hear anything officially anyway. Just due to the newness of the building, the size, and the potential.
Mm-hmm.
Just looking forward down the road, see
if
it does occur.
Yeah, we would. There would be a process by which they'd have to get approval through the Department of Ed, and all sending districts would have an opportunity to share the impact on the community as the Department of Ed weighs whether or not to make that approval.
Thank you.
Do we do surveys, or can we do surveys to the families that elect to send a child to charter schools, kind of like finding out why?
So, we can. I have thought about it. It's from a capacity standpoint. We're not sending a ton of kids to the charter and outside. I think that there's a narrative out there that we've lost a lot of students, and the enrollment report's not really reflective of that. So from a internal capacity and lift, it's just something that's been on my mind, but we haven't proceeded with. I also think too, philosophically, I don't want to come across as hounding people or violating their rights to choose where they may want to send their child. So it's something that I also would want to kind of like tread carefully around.
Yeah.
But people also do share why they may send their child to a particular school. I think that the World Language Program at the elementary level and some of the STEM offerings at the charter school in particular are very attractive to families. And I've heard that from people who've offered that up. There's also family history, siblings, a legacy type of thing where people may choose to send their child based on that. And then lately the big trend has been an increase in homeschool families, some of whom feel that the schools are not safe because of COVID, and some of whom don't want their children to be wearing masks and object to the mask mandate and choose to keep their children home. So that we've seen both of that. So it's more like qualitative input that people have shared. So I've definitely thought about it. It's just a capacity thing we haven't necessarily done.
Yeah, yeah, okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
And most people go to charter just starting kindergarten.
Yes, yeah.
Because I feel like when they love their school, they're gonna just say we stay here because of this, not because they made a choice of two different things. Like, you know.
Most, with the charter, absolutely, it's mostly a kindergarten choice, that initial enrollment. Yep.
I think we just hear a lot of happy talk about what they like about their school, instead of like anything that would be feedback for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right, I guess, yeah.
Because once it's like your team, like you don't question why your team is your team, because they've always been your team.
Yeah.
Well, I had heard like that anecdotally about the specifically the world languages, but I didn't know how much of an impact is that, or is it other factors?
Yeah, I hear about language all the time. Families looking for world language at the elementary level. It's come up often enough over 5 years that I think that there's something real there. And I think there's a value.
That it's artistic over there. Like that's what I've heard when people say, well, they have more opportunities for the arts. Mm-hmm. I don't know what that means.
I hear about community projects. Like they have a community, like a service.
Yeah, that he's doing.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And so that brings us to any final thoughts and questions.
Camille, anything?
No.
Dave?
Just thanks for putting up problem with my questions.
No. Appreciate it. Happy to.
One question regarding the DART website. They showed this to us, or mentioned it during training the course, and there was a comparison where they gave you, I think it was like 12 towns that were comparable. Mm-hmm. Are those the same towns that you would use, or do you have like your own school districts that you prefer to use to compare Franklin to?
Yeah, good question.
I think it depends on the question that you're asking. Right. So for like salary comps, I wouldn't use the DART data.
Okay.
I would look more regionally at, because we're kind of in competition with districts in the region. So that's one example where I wouldn't use DART data. But DART data, I think, becomes helpful for like per pupil expenditure, because you're talking about similar demographics and size, and that may be relevant.
Okay.
Dave, any questions?
Not this time. I'm sure I'll have plenty of them next few months. I got your number, Mary.
I know you do.
Elise?
I'm all set.
All right,
I'm all set too. Thank you very much, Miriam. This is really helpful.
You're welcome.
Thank you. All right, downstairs. So, there's nothing else. We'll adjourn. Head downstairs.
We are now producing this in collaboration with Franklin TV and Franklin Public Radio. This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but we can't do it alone. We can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information that you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like something here, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements. And I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is titled Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tintype Tunes in 2008. And used with their permission. I hope you enjoy. By the way, you can also subscribe and listen to Franklin Matters Radio on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Search in podcasts for Franklin Matters.